Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Irina Raine. Irina Raine is the author of the novel What Happened to Anna Kay, chosen by Entertainment Weekly as one of the 10 best fiction books of 2008. She's also the editor of the nonfiction anthology Living on the Edge of the World, New Jersey Writers Take on the Garden State. She teaches creative writing at the University of Pittsburgh, and she'll be reading from her novel, What Happened to Anna Kay, this evening. Hi, Irina. Welcome to Prosody.
Hi, Ellen. Thank you. It's great to be here.
How about we start off tonight with you reading a little bit from the novel?
Sure. That would be great. I'm going to start with reading chapter 2, which is called The Proposal, The Chocolate Ring, and The End. And I don't know how many people know that What Happened to Anna Kay is actually a reimagining of Tolstoy's Anna Karenina. So at this point in the novel, Anna Kay is sort of being set up with her suitable husband material. So this is really at the beginning of the book. The Proposal, The Chocolate Ring, The End. Wasn't it Mama who first uttered Alexei K.'s name to Anna? Yes, Anna was sure of it. Her mother had just attended an anniversary party at Riba on Avenue O in Brooklyn, where her daughter's hopeless 35-year-old state was discussed, her life splayed out side by side with the eggplant caviar, the cheese blintzes with sour cream. After the party, she had called her daughter. Anyusha, we finally found you a promising man. I have one word for you, Alexander K. That's two words, Ma, and why do you always have to talk about my love life with your friends? No, Anna, her mother said. At this point, we have a right to discuss you. We are truly worried now. For hadn't Anna frittered her 20s away, dating schmucks who were always leaving the country? Men who could barely pay for themselves, who wore frayed T-shirts to fancy restaurants. I mean, it wasn't serious. Why was Anna wasting her time when rich Russian, some even Jewish, oil magnates were infiltrating New York, snapping up wives for their sons along with billion-dollar apartments in the Time Warner Center? So what's your point, Ma? But to be honest, Anna herself was starting to get worried. This was not the way it was supposed to turn out. All she knew was that the hazy fantasy she had nursed practically since immigration had not materialized. How would she know if it had? If she were accompanying her husband to the National Book Awards, getting ready in her Upper West Side walk-in closet, flying to pick up furniture at the Art Basel Miami Design Show? If he surprised her with Joyce tickets and then popped her into a Hao Xiaoshen movie praising, quote, Hao's mastery of mise-en-scene. And at the end of the day, in her reveries, her mythical husband would make enthusiastic love to her body, would lavish upon it worshipful caresses, kisses of bottomless awe, and then, still red from exertion, from the pleasure he was able to evoke, would look through her as though performing a biopsy on her soul. They would rise from bed, only to part the curtains to gaze down on the metallic skyline of New York City. They would open a bottle of Châteauneuf du Pape, blah, blah, blah. Was this really science fiction? No, she was sure it was possible. Otherwise, why would Woody Allen's old films always be on television when she was at her most optimistic? Those tastefully decorated loft apartments, those stimulating dinner parties, dropping names like E.E. Cummings, Kierkegaard, Dostoevsky, Bergman. How many young women have those movies ruined? For God's sakes, even her parents no longer read Dostoevsky. Haven't they suffered enough, they would say? After 30 years of communism, didn't they deserve Danielle Steele? Well, Viola's grandmother has a sister whose son is single, her mother says. Sounds old. He probably never found the right woman, the smart woman, to grab him. And I hate to remind you, my dear, you are no young chicken yourself. Another Russian date. And what was one more? Hadn't she been on millions of dates with exactly the same guy? Businessman come gym connoisseur come superficial art lover? The educated Russian emphasis on culture forcing him to spend a few minutes before a Monet or Renoir? The one book gathering dust on his bedside table? The Seven Effective Ways to or Donald Trump's Guide to? Always a hazy business deal in the works. Just one more year and that investment would finally pay off. The loving attention paid to a sports car eternally sitting in some Russian-owned parking lot near the BQE. The Gucci label, mysteriously affixed to the outside of his clothing, where it gleamed a chalky silver. A man whose mother, who are we kidding, was still doing his laundry, still fixing him dinner every night. They were always looking for Russian girls who would understand them, the feminine, sophisticated ladies so sorely absent in American culture, they said. But the truth was that American girls didn't automatically do laundry for their husbands. They were not as enslaved by their own beauty to its future demise to have to do it.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Irina Rain, reading from her novel, What Happened to Anna Kay? So, Irina, I have to ask the obvious question.
Uh-oh.
Which is, this is a pretty ambitious project to say, how about yes. I'll have my first novel be a reimagining of Anna Karenina? So I just wanted to ask, like, how did it start?
Well, I think that it would have been a little more bold if I actually did go ahead and set out to do that. But I think ultimately I took a class on Anna Karenina, and I think that that book really seeped inside me. So when I was writing my own work, I kind of started to see the parallels coming out from my own work. So I think it's the fact that Anna Karenina sort of emerged organically from what I was already doing that made this book possible.
So the work that you were working on, was it fiction or nonfiction?
Fiction. I had several short stories. I was in an MFA program at the time, and I was writing several short stories. And one was about a sort of Russian immigrant like myself with some issues. And then the other one was about a Bukharian Jewish pharmacist who was trying to figure out where he fit in his traditional community. And then I suddenly looked at the two together and thought, well, why not combine these stories?
Sure. Well, good for you and, you know, a beautiful work that's come out of it. The book itself is obviously – there's a lot about displacement in it, both Anna's community in the sense of being immigrants to the U.S., but also Anna within her own community because her family still has much stronger connections and memories. She came over here really young. And I was thinking, you know, how – tricky, and maybe that's not true, and you'll correct me in that, it must be to write a character who seems to be constantly moving in terms of figuring out who she is by who she is not. Could you talk about a little bit like how you came to know her? I mean, was it something that came out of the writing or was it echoes that you were kind of bouncing back and forth between this and you know, Anna Karenina?
I think as far as the displacement questions, they were, you know, definitely came from my own life, having immigrated at the age of 7 here to the U.S. And I think that since then, there has been a kind of constant struggle to figure out what the identity is. And I think ultimately I came around to this idea that, you know, an immigrant identity is its own space that is neither one nor the other. So in all those years of trying to figure out how I was going to be becoming American, I realized it was a never-ending process. It was something that was never going to happen, you know, at the same time as I was never going to be Russian again either. So I realized that what I was doing is occupying this third sphere. And how you navigate that third sphere was what I was interested in this book, because the two characters, Lev and Anna, both navigated in very different ways. And it could be a very destructive experience, just like it might be an experience where you sort of make peace with this kind of liminal space you occupy and learn to live within that space.
Yeah, what I thought was really interesting in the blend of this book, and I guess it's the, you know, it fits into that reimagining of it, is that there's a lot of pop culture references. There are a lot of references to a particular kind of culture, family traditions, all these things that they just live together.
You know, they're not meant to necessarily – they might have a tension between them or fight against each other. But it did feel to me like this third space that it's just – you know, you can have two things that – a very ancient cultural reference and, you know, the most recent pop culture reference. And they can live side by side and be equal in a certain sense. Mm. And that's fine.
Exactly. And that's what's interesting. That third space pulls in what it needs. It pulls in He-Man and, you know, Hungry Hippos. And it also pulls in Nabokov and, you know, and Dostoevsky. And I mean, it takes what it needs from all those various places. And I think that's what makes it such an interesting place.
Yeah. Even just in the piece you read, the idea of haven't we read Dostoevsky enough? Like, can't we – haven't we earned Daniel Steele at this point? That I just think is something that you know, it was very fresh for me in this book that I don't remember reading in other even stories where the characters are immigrants, because they always seem to be trying to become American. And what's really fascinating about Anna is that she's just trying to be herself. Yeah. She's trying to figure out what that is.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me that question has – if for me, you know, as a writer and as a person, I think that question of becoming American has been in a certain way resolved, where I realized it was an impossible pursuit. So I think when I'd read a lot of books, too, sort of in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, that were occupied with this question of immigration as becoming American. And I was actually in an anthology called Becoming American. Mm. So it's clearly a question I thought a lot about. And I guess by the time I came to write this book, I realized it was an impossible mission and that instead the questions lay elsewhere.
Great. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Irina Rain, reading from her novel, What Happened to Anna Kay. Will you read some more, Irina?
Sure. I thought that I would give a sense of sort of the omniscient perspective in this book by reading the chapter that comes right after the chapter I just read, and it's called The Great Russian Soul. And this is the omniscient perspective. Like I felt like Tolstoy was allowed the omniscient perspective, and so was I. We cannot continue the story of Anna Kay without tackling the issue of the Russian soul, Великая Русская Душа. Much ink has been spilled on it, but no one can adequately articulate what it entails. It is generally agreed that the term is hazy and amorphous, an exclusive gift for the suffering Russians. Does it have anything to do with bitter cold, communist timetables, policing grandmothers? The addictive qualities of vodka? Wars fought with little training, shoddy clothing and primitive equipment? An affection for murderous dictators? Ambivalence about the westernizing innovations of Peter the Great? Fyodor Dostoevsky called it, quote, the Russian disease, an indifference toward everything that is vital, toward the truth of life, everything that nourishes life and generates health. But is there any truth to any of it, or is it just a story, a myth created to justify one's suffering? Does it have something to do with this tuska everyone talks about, this longing for the motherland, a misty-eyed nostalgia for God knows what, God knows when? And what happens to the great Russian soul when it is transplanted? Can it flourish in Rigo Park, Queens, for example? The Russians around Anna had their own immigrant interpretations of this phenomenon. To Anna, this is what the Russian soul in America looked like. Number one, shopping extortions. In department stores, a Russian friend encourages Anna to clip a $200 price tag for a Fendi scarf and surreptitiously exchange it with a $35 sales tag belonging to a Nike sports bra. Two, rebuke from strangers. How often has Anna found herself scolded by Russians in public places? Maybe if you hadn't wandered away, Devushka, you wouldn't have lost your spot in line, being an example of leftover schadenfreude that used to be exercised in millions of lines around the Soviet Union. Three, suspicion of positive sentiments. In Anna's observation, Russians avoided voicing praise, presumably to ward off the evil eye. If the young Anna Reutemann received compliments from a Russian adult, chances were she either lost a significant amount of weight or they lacked a Russian soul. Four, indifference to the enjoyment of others. How often had Anna overheard exceedingly loud conversations, say, about a friend's abortion during a Met performance of Don Giovanni? If Anna tried to shush the two women, she would inevitably receive an earful. And 5, fondness for politically incorrect jokes. Anna could never understand the mysterious proliferation of anekdote passed via internet and retold around dinner tables, skewering impotent men, mistresses, dissatisfied wives, alcoholism, peasants, excessive stupidity, old-school communists, Chapayev, Stalin, Putin, Georgians, Bukharians, Jews, lesbians, and other non-Russian personages. Anna immigrated to America at a young age, and therefore the humor of the punchlines passed her by completely.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Irina Rain, reading from her novel, What Happened to Anna Kay. I want to talk about the tone of the book for a minute. There's this, again, it feels to me like it's an in-between space. It's like a great tragedy almost told as a punchline often. And was this a tone, is this a voice that was just natural to you that came up? Was it something you had to work on a bit?
I think this tone felt new for me for the book. I've used humor in different ways in my work before, and I've used the opposite, real tragedy and dark kind of sensibility. And I felt like it was I think this tone kind of wrote the book in a certain way. I think once I found that voice that sort of balance between those two, it allowed me to actually see a whole book through. It was clearly the voice that I was supposed to use.
Yeah, because I would say it's the tone that when we shift between these kind of omnipotent, here's where we're going to talk about the Russian soul versus kind of, the close attachment to Anna, that there is a really smooth transition. You don't even really realize it until afterwards. You're like, wait a minute, we weren't in Anna's head at that moment. We were in a bigger place than that.
Yeah.
Was the tone hard to manage at all, or just once you found it flew?
I think it's once I let myself be able to go in and out. And, we have Anna's consciousness here, but we also have a random videographer at a wedding. We go dip into his mind. And I think it's dipping into all these minds that allowed me that kind of freedom. I think if I was just sort of with Anna's point of view the whole way, I'd be limiting myself, I think, in a certain way. And the fact that the tone was able to go from voice to voice to character omniscience, to the author, supposed author, quote unquote. So I think that's what allowed that to happen.
Yeah, and it felt very contemporary to me. And maybe it's because of the kind of language that's used, because, that is something we don't see in literature very often anymore. Yes. We're kind of used to it being with Dostoevsky or, some of the Victorian writers, this idea of this omnipotent voice that leads us around and periodically lets us just peek into somebody's head.
Yes.
But the choice of the language, I had to stop and say, wait a minute, this isn't the usual technique that's used any longer.
Yes, I think omniscience has gone out of style in a certain way. And I think you do have to know your material to try omniscience. I think it's a tricky point of view, but I think there's a lot of rewards to be had in being able to step a little bit away from subjectivity and give your thoughts on the events of the book.
And I think there is a way it allows, maybe in a traditional sense, we think of it as just being the device for kind of more weighty subjects. But in this book, it does allow for some humor and some kind of tongue-in-cheek kind of viewing of oneself in one's culture.
Right. The omniscient voice doesn't have to be moralizing. It could be fun.
Absolutely.
It could be funny.
Absolutely. I wanted to ask, also, there's a kind of running theme in the book about literature. And Anna, at different times, she's kind of always kind of thinking in these ways, like she gets a crush on one of her first writing instructors and thinks, oh, he's like me because he's using fairy tales to try and figure out how life works. And then she's always kind of casting her potential boyfriends as either Heathcliff's or Darcy's and herself as the heroine. And, I think that's something that we do, and maybe with kind of, people in their teens and their 20s, they might do it more with film than with literature, though. Yeah. It'd be great if they did it with literature, too. And so I was thinking that in a way was also kind of negotiating this third space that was a way that everybody could relate to. Because even if you're not someone who's trying to figure out your identity within another culture, you're always kind of escaping into these other characters.
Yeah. Or you let or you let fiction or art of some sort, you know, give you a narrative for your own life, which is a very kind of artificial construction of a life, that it goes by a narrative arc. But I think so many of us do that. When you think about romantic comedies, or, you know, as you know, even a genre that maybe teaches young women how to navigate the romantic terrain, which is completely false. And I think Anna kind of gives into it a little bit, perhaps with books, where she thinks that that's the way life could be.
Well, and because, you know, again, as she's trying to figure out her place in this, you know, huge change that a number of us do not experience unless we were to go live in another culture for an extended period of time. You know, she's almost reading them or kind of invoking them in her life, almost like trying to read a map. Like, yeah. Well, this is how it's supposed to be. Mm-hmm. So I'll just keep following this direction. And then ultimately that's where her disappointment and her kind of disjointedness comes through, because, of course, it's not realistic. It's not a map.
Right, right. And I think there is something universal about that, too. I think it's not only immigrants. You know, it's not only a question for immigrants. It's a question, how do we all, you know, figure out how to lead a life? And some of us perhaps who were a little too – read too many books in our youth might sometimes make that mistake, too.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Irina Rain, reading from her novel, What Happened to Anna Kay. Would you read a bit more for us?
Okay, well, I thought this for my third section, I would read from Lev's point of view. And he comes from a community of Bukharian Jews, which is a community not many people actually know about. And it is Jews from the former Soviet Union, but who have emigrated from places like Uzbekistan and Tajikistan. And they are a very different kind of community than the sort of secular, quote unquote, Russian Jews that have came from Moscow or St. Petersburg, for example. So they're a very kind of close-knit, tight-knit community, patriarchal, you know, it's a very different kind of community. So in here, Lev, it's a chapter called Vasilisa the Beautiful, and this is where Lev's at a wedding and wondering why it's not his turn, because, you know, weddings are extremely important and young girls get married young, and, you know, it's extremely important to continue the traditions of this culture. So I'll just read a little bit. This was Lev's fifth wedding this month, and still not his own. Just last weekend, he had attended the K's wedding, though he no longer remembered how his family knew the K's, who were not Bukharian Jews at all, but from Moscow. The Pinchas of wedding, his best friend's, was held at one of the usual places on Queens Boulevard, just a stroll from the homes of most of the guests. By now, the dancing was well underway. The slightly intoxicated Orthodox rabbi fled the room when the female singer took over the microphone. Once a famous opera singer in Russia in the 1960s and 70s, she was here crooning sentimental Soviet ballads, Bukharian folk songs, and hits by the Bee Gees. Lev was sick of it, and worst of all, the quality of the girls being seated next to him at weddings these days was quickly deteriorating. This one had eyes spaced too close together, and the underside of her jaw was dotted with acne. "So what do you do for a living?" she uttered, this original, scintillating question. Lev barely brought himself to look at her, a flat, banana-shaped body camouflaged in sheets of taffeta. "I'm a pharmacist. I do not repair shoes. Is that what you want to hear?" On dates, Buchi women always ask the same question. "How much do you make? Do you own a house in Forest Hills? What kind of car do you drive?" It was unsubtle, unromantic. Lev saw them mentally calculating right there at the restaurant after he gave them his answer, gripping their martini glasses by the stem, thinking, "Will I have to shop discount? Will I have a cleaning lady? Will I have to work if I don't want to?" In the French films Lev loved, women never let on those kinds of thoughts. They were soft and yielding in their high heels, in their clinging blouses.
When I was reading the book, I was also thinking about the audience for the book. And mm-hmm. I was wondering if you were thinking about, well, I mean, I think every writer thinks about it. And to me, it feels like this book has audiences.
Yes.
People who might have the same experience as Anna. Then also kind of people who were older when they immigrated and would think, oh, this is what this generation is going to be like. And then people like myself who don't have this experience but can feel connect with the character on, you know, a number of different levels. We all feel displaced in different ways. But I have to say, I felt like I was a visitor in this book, that this was something that was not necessarily meant for me to understand everything. Were you thinking about that when you were writing, about who your audiences were?
I think so. I mean, a little bit. I don't really think too much about the audience when I'm writing, but I do feel like you're right that I think different kinds of people will get different things from the book. There's a certain exotic aspect, like you were saying, that there's, you know, some people or some readers have come to me thinking that, you know, I'm plunged into this other world, this exotic world that I really have no access to. While, of course, there's plenty of people who said, I am Anna. You know, I've had many young Russian American women come to me with that, which made me a little scared. But, you know, so there were plenty of people that identified with it, people who, you know, found it a new and exotic world. And I think that there's, you know, pleasures to be had. There's also Tolstoy lovers, you know. So I think that, you know, there's different kinds of pleasures to be had for different people.
Yeah. Well, Irina, I want to thank you so much for coming to Prosody tonight.
Thank you so much, Ellen. It was a pleasure.
You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the arts entertainment news weekly published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody, an independent public radio, 91.3 WYEP.